Well, welcome back to the interactive portion of the program. Our special guest, Jude Sutherland Kessler. Her latest book is called Should Have Known Better, Volume 4 in the John Lennon series, based on 1 year, 1964. But we will take your calls when we come back on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back, Jude Sutherland Kessler with us. Jude, whose idea was it amongst the Beatles to keep control of their records? Or their library?
You mean the rights to their songs?
Yes.
Yes. Well, definitely Brian Epstein. I don't know that John and Paul would have considered this something of importance at the very beginning. They really weren't savvy in the business world, nor did they consider it something that they should deal with.
They just wanted to do music and make records.
Right, exactly, and have fun and enjoy it. And that was something that Brian handled. And really, I mean, Brian has received so much criticism for the way he dealt with the Beatles, but it was unprecedented what happened to them. And all the groups that come after, whether you're talking about the Stones or the Dave Clark Five or the Yardbirds, Cream, they're following in the Beatles' footsteps. So he was doing something for the first time that hadn't been done in England. There'd never been a major rock group or in England. So I think he did the best he could do at the time, and he did suggest to them that they form a corporation and that they retain the rights to their music. Of course, as we all know, years later, when Paul McCartney is making a record with Michael Jackson, in a very friendly and fatherly sort of way, he says to Michael, "You know, Michael, a really good way to invest your money is to buy music rights." And that's, Michael announces to him very shortly thereafter, "Paul, I've bought your music."
He went after his.
Yeah,
that's great.
So, I mean, I think he thought it was a flattering thing to do, and Paul was not happy. But, you know, it was at the beginning, they were not political at all. They were not speaking out on major issues. They just wanted to get up on the stage and play music and have a great time.
I didn't like Sgt. Pepper. I didn't get it at that time. How about you?
Yeah. I did not get it. And I did not understand why the greatest band in the world would want to pretend to be someone else. You know, and as I say, it's a very McCartney-centric LP. I know all the Paul fans out there must love it. I just did not understand it, and they don't carry the theme forward. They wear the costumes. They do an opening song that says we're Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band,
right.
And Billy Shears.
And Strawberry Fields, right?
Yeah. Well, then he sings with a little help from my friends, but then they drop it. They drop the persona, and they drop the names, and they drop it, and they just make an LP. So, especially Within You, Without You was not my favorite. I think it was the one track on my album that looked pristine and new. I as a girl, a young girl from Louisiana, northern Louisiana, I did not at all get it.
John would have been 80 years old in October of this year. Wonder what he would have been doing. You think he still would have been touring, singing?
Well, I tell you, I know that you had Ken Womack on the show very recently.
Right.
And Ken has just released, in fact, I think today was the day that he released his new book, John Lennon 1980, one of the best books I have ever read on John Lennon. And he has this quote, I love, love, love it. He says, "John was of two minds about things. Indeed, his endlessly fecund, always vacillating mind may have been his most salient personality trait. He was forever in a state of flux regarding anything and anyone, including himself." So, as John Lennon said to Larry Kane in an interview one time when he was just a little bit high, "This thing is wide open, man." I think the future would have been wide open for John. John never saw any reason to be loyal to any idea he had had the day before. If the thing changed slightly, he changed slightly.
He changed.
If it changed a lot, he changed a lot. He starts off fairly liberal as a young man, but by the time that he's nearing 40 in 1979, he's become a fan of Ronald Reagan. He's moving more centrist, and so he never thought that he should cling to any idea because it was the idea that he had yesterday. So what would he have done? We have no idea. He could have changed completely from the way he was when he was 40. But what was he doing in 1980? I mean, it may give us some sort of clue. He's just put out, as you said a few moments ago, this great album, Double Fantasy, with Yoko. He's already planned in March of 1981 to go on tour. They're going to go on a European tour first. They're going to go to Paris. They're going to go to Tokyo. They're going to come back and do some gigs in the UK. They're going to do a US tour. He had already picked out the cities and the dates and everything. And he was writing new songs for the next LP to come out in 81. So he was back in the music world. I think it's safe to say, although I'm not sure, that he would have been highly involved in music. I feel certain he would have loved the alternative music of the 1990s. In fact, we lived in Kansas City in the 1990s, and there was an alternative bar there that had a picture of John above the door, and it said the father of alternative music. I can just see him loving that music of the 1990s. The only thing that I really believe is that John would not have any way been the John that is featured in the movie Yesterday. He would not have been some loner living away on an island, painting and saying, just find the girl, mm-hmm. and that's all you need, and you'll be happy, because he'd never been that way. When he was 3 years old, he was the captain of a gang of boys who were older than he was. He would say, you're going to be an Indian, you're going to be a cowboy, yeah. and when they'd say,
always in charge.
Say, shut up, I'm the boss. He was always all in. He was always full of action. He was leading a movement. He was leading 5,000 people that marched on BOAC in New York City to protest the presence of the English in Ireland. He was a doer, and there's no way he would have been that quiet, reclusive man who was in Yesterday. Whatever he was doing, he would have been all in.
Was he deeply in love with Yoko?
He and Yoko were in love. There's no doubt about it. But they had horrible problems the first year. That's something that people don't talk about. He said to her, I'm used to having women wait on me. And Mimi waited on me, his aunt, and Cynthia, my first wife, waited on me. And she said, well, if that's what you want, then I'm leaving. I mean, she was going.
Wow.
And so people criticize Yoko for following John into the studio. It wasn't that she followed him into the studio. He followed her. He made her go everywhere with him because he was afraid that she was going to abandon him, just like his mother abandoned
him. Was he that insecure, huh?
That insecure. And he was messy. He left his stuff around. She told him he had to clean up. They had quite a few fights, so much so that by the spring of 1973, she's had all she can stand, and she sends him away, and he goes away with the lovely, inspiring, calm May Pang. They go to Los Angeles for a while. He sows some wild oats. They come back to New York and live. They're together 18 months, and he falls deeply in love with May Pang. And only when he's summoned by Yoko to come back to the Dakota to pick up some of his things, and then he doesn't come back, May knows when he leaves to go do this errand. She's not going to see him again. She begs him not to go, but he does. And then he doesn't come back, and he and Yoko reunite. But this was not a lost weekend. He was deeply in love with May. She made him reconcile with his son, his first son, Julian, and she made him make things better with his first wife, Cynthia. He invited Julian to come over. They took him to Disneyland. She had him write music. He produces Walls and Bridges while he's with her. Great LP, one of his best. She believed in him. She was good for him. So he had a deep love for May as well. And after 1975, he and Yoko get back together. But, they had their struggles just like every other couple.
And his son Julian, 57 years old, is somewhat still in the business, isn't he?
He does so much. He is such a talented photographer, and he has written 3 books for children in the last few years about saving the earth and treasuring the earth. He has the White Feather Foundation, which does all sorts of wonderful things, such as gives college scholarships to girls in nations where, you know, there's no way that they could ever afford to go to school. He really, Julian Lennon, very quietly, without a lot of fuss, goes about doing good for the planet. And he once hosted New Year's Rockin' Eve for Dick Clark. And I want to tell you what, the man is a great television host. It's too bad that he never did that, because he was as good as Dick Clark ever was, and Dick Clark never invited him to come back. He's done some voiceover work, multi-talented, not to mention his number one songs that he had, Too Late for Goodbyes and Balak.
And Yoko's still alive. She's about 87, isn't she?
Yes. Yeah, she's in a wheelchair now, but still active, still very sharp, brilliant woman, very bold, very strong.
Where does she live?
Eight years older than John, and he called her mother, very much like his mother, Julia. You know, when he sings that song, Julia, on the White Album, and he says, Ocean Child, he calls his mother Ocean Child. That's what Yoko means in Japanese. So he really combined the images of those two women together into one.
Is she in the States or England?
She's still in the States, still in New York City, and she is loved by her son, Sean, who was born on John's birthday, and, you know, they worked so hard. They had four miscarriages and really wanted a child and were so excited to have Sean. So, you know, he has been very faithful to her. He's talented, too, and has written many dance mix type songs and is very popular in New York. So, you know, it's just a shame that Sean never got to really know his dad. He was gone far too soon.
Okay, let's go to the phones now. Let's start by going to Richard in Kentucky, first-time caller. Hey, Richard, thanks for calling.
Hey, how you doing?
Okay, thank you.
I've got the 1963 newspaper. I can't read and write. I've got a learning disability, and it talks about Elvis and Cape Canal and the Beatles and, I mean, everything. I've been trying to get a hold of this show for a very long time. I got three Facebook pages. You can look on my page. I've been posting them on my thing. Of course, I've been being blocked from social media, but they cut out a lot of everything. I've got the 1963, November the 22nd, the day that John F. Kennedy got shot. It talks about the Cape Canal. I never did read the part about the Elvis part because I like Elvis and I didn't want to find the part out, but it's, I don't know. It's pretty cool stuff. If you can look on my line, or if I had some way to get a hold of you, George, to try to get you some of this information, because I'm telling you, it's I got the paper because I like Pete Rose, and I was doing a job for a guy, and I said, man, I'd like to have that. And he said, well, if you want that, you got to take all the newspapers, and I've got the November. I mean, it's the Louisville Times newspapers, and I can't find them nowhere else. And they
definitely
up.
Hold on to those things, Richard. Don't lose those. Those things must be classics, Jude. Jude, are you with us?
Oh, yeah, sorry. They are classics. I was so fortunate to have a lady give me her scrapbooks from 1963 and 1964. So I bet you and I have some of the same articles that we have. You know, she had, I don't think she was from the Louisville area, but probably covering the same topics. And I agree with George. Those are treasures. So definitely hang on to them.
That's true. I don't want that. That wouldn't be fair, but definitely save those. Thomas in La Jolla, California. Hey, Tom, go ahead.
Hi, George, and hi, Jude. Great
Hello. Conversation.
Or you could say, hey, Jude, whatever you want.
There we go. Anyway, you know, in the 1960s, before Sgt. Pepper's and before the White Album, there was another album, and it was called Revolver. And I believe it was 1966, and it was about the time Brian Epstein had passed away. And Revolver was experimental, transitional, very dark, moody, edgy, if you will. And yet it was very creative. And I felt, and a lot of people felt at the time, that the Beatles were in transition, and it may be just maybe their most creative album. And I was wondering if you would speak about the inception of the album Revolver and any stories you know, et cetera.
Yeah, I couldn't agree with you more. If I had to point to one album as their transition album, Revolver moves them from a performance band, a stage band, that loves to do cover songs. I mean, you look at an album like With the Beatles, where seven of their songs are covers and seven are original. They see nothing wrong with doing covers because they're entertainers. They're a stage band. Then after Revolver, they're definitely just a studio band. In fact, some of the songs can't be reproduced on stage, even if they wanted to, because it's something that's done in studio. I did not like Revolver when it first came out. Like you, I felt it was a little bit dark. It was edgy. It was some of the songs, Look at All the Lonely People, were really depressing. And John's songs, Tomorrow Never Knows, and She Said, that's metal music. You've moved into another kind of music. He has leapt away from the age of She Loves You or I'll Cry Instead or Help right into Jefferson Airplane territory. I mean, he's leapt into a much heavier form of music, and I didn't get it. But then I read a book called Revolver, How the Beatles Reimagined Rock and Roll by Robert Rodriguez. And for the first time, I got Revolver. For the first time, it was like reading a pop-up book. I got every song. I understood what they were trying to do. It made sense to me. I cannot recommend that book highly enough. Revolver, How the Beatles Reimagined Rock and Roll, Robert Rodriguez. And after ever I read that book, I adored Revolver. I understood what they were trying to achieve. You know, they start to bring in instruments as early as Norwegian Wood when they introduce the sitar. They begin to bring in instruments that are not considered rock and roll. You know, Got to Get You Into My Life on Revolver has horns and that sound that's going to be Blood, Sweat, and Tears. They are, as you say, they're transitioning to a more sophisticated studio band. And even though they didn't have all the edges honed and have it polished, they're on their way to what is going to become the White Album. So, you know, what I once thought was sort of a ragged album, I have great respect for now. I think you would love that book.
Jude, what would you ask John Lennon if you had a chance to sit down with him and interview him?
Well, I have some questions that are really biographical in nature. There are several things that I'm very inquisitive about. In fact, when he took Cynthia on their honeymoon to Paris in 1963, he remained in Paris after she went home. And I would love to know the end of that story and what he was doing. In fact, I've been trying to track it down. But I guess the main thing that I would like to ask him is, you know, John, you spent your whole entire life trying to fill the hole in your heart from your mother and father leaving you when you were 4.5 years old. You thought you could fill it by getting to the toppermost of the poppermost. You thought you could fill it with riches, with fame, with popularity. You thought, maybe if I get another wife, maybe if I take drugs, maybe if I visit the Maharishi, maybe if I become a peace activist, nothing ever seemed to fill the hole in your heart. Was there, before your death, ever a moment when you were truly happy? Did it ever happen for you? I'd love to know that.
We're going to come back in a moment and take some final phone calls with Jude Sutherland Kessler as we talk about her latest book, Should Have Known Better. Let's find out where you can buy it when we come back. On our next Coast to Coast program, Mark Carlotto joins us talking about ancient civilizations that go way back. And then later on, Psychic Bob joins us. So it should be a classic Coast to Coast program. And welcome back to Coast, our final segment with Jude Sutherland Kessler. Were you named after that song, Hey Jude, by any chance?
Oh, unfortunately, I wasn't. I was Judith growing up and Judy to all my friends. And then, of course, when the Beatles era rolled around, it was either Jude or Southey. And so when I started writing, Jude was a perfect name to use, fit right in with the Beatles.
Where were you born?
in Alexandria, Louisiana, central Louisiana, and my husband went to the Naval Academy. We've been married for 40-some-odd years, and we have moved 32 times.
Oh, my
so
gosh.
We have lived all over the United States, Los Angeles being one of the places that we lived and where our son was born.
How did you end up in Liverpool for a little bit?
When I started writing the book about 4 years before my first trip to Liverpool, and because I'm telling it as a story but documenting everything, I had to know where all of the buildings were in relationship to one another. What do you see when you walk out of the Cavern Club where the Beatles performed over 300 times? Which direction do you walk to go to City Center? What does Ye Crack look like? What does it smell like? I had to go to be able to write with authority, and I needed to conduct interviews with everyone John went to high school with and to college with, his roommate in college, the woman that he emulated, June Furlong, who was the life model at Liverpool College of Art. She was famous. He wanted to know, how did you get to be famous? All of his early band members. And so to do that, every single year between 1993 and 2000, I went to Liverpool for 8 days a week and spent all day long doing interviews and meeting with people and gathering information. And it was just such a wonderful experience. And all of the people of Liverpool contributed to these books. They would say, send me my chapter, I'll make corrections, and I'll send it back to you. And they were very meticulous. I mean, Bill Harry said, okay, you've got me in Ye Crack. That's right. That's where I hung out. But you have me sitting in the front room. I sat in the back room. Put me under the painting of Lord Nelson, and you have me ordering ale. I only drank bitters. So, you know, with that kind of detail, how can you go wrong?
Will we ever have the kind of excitement that we had with the Beatles with groups again?
You know, it's possible, because that phenomenon happened one time before in America. But with literature, you have this small, little, quiet city of Concord, Massachusetts, and all of a sudden, for no reason, you have Thoreau, Emerson, Alcott, Hawthorne, Margaret Sidney, a huge group of world-changing authors who spring up and live together in this one place at this one time. And the same thing happens with the Beatles. They all grow up within 3 miles of one another. Absolutely would never have crossed paths, though, because they're in different parts of town, had not people felt that they belonged together and introduced them to one another, made a point to bring them together because they felt that they belonged together. So, I mean, it could happen again. There could be another explosion, maybe an art next time. But it was very, very magical. There is one story of the Beatles wanting to go to Hamburg. And as you know, the Beatles would never have been the Beatles had they not gone to Hamburg. Hamburg teaches them to be a great band, gives them a musical repertoire, gives them stamina, gives them determination to live in the worst of conditions in order to get to the best of conditions. Hmm. But they've been asking this man named Alan Williams, who owned the Jacaranda Coffee House, please get us a gig in Hamburg. Please get us a gig. And so he makes a tape of them. He travels to Hamburg. He sits down with this big owner of various clubs in the city, and he takes his reel-to-reel tape, puts it on the man's tape player, and there is nothing. There is silence. Nothing. Nothing. And he tries in his broken German and with a translator to tell Bruno Kaschmieder how great these Beatles are. And, of course, Bruno doesn't buy it. So Alan leaves and goes home, and the boys are so disappointed. Well, fate will not have it that way. Will not have it that way. So another group, Derry and the Seniors, had been promised a gig in the seaside city of Blackpool. When they show up, the gig has been canceled, and they threaten to beat Alan up. They say, we've had it with you, and they're getting ready to beat him up. And he says, wait, don't do that. I'm going to take you to London, and I'm going to get you a gig at the biggest club in London, the Two Eyes, on Saturday night. He drives down with Derry and the Seniors to London, and that night, there is no band slated, and Derry and the Seniors take the boards. They're fabulous. They're rocking the house, and a man with a patch over his eye walks up to Alan Williams and says, there's a guy sitting in the back of the bar who wants to know where this group is from. He wants to talk to you. And, of course, you know what I'm getting ready to say. When Alan Williams strolls to the back of the bar, there sits Bruno Kaschmieder from Hamburg, the very man that he played the tape for, the tape that was silent. And Bruno and Alan can't talk to each other because Bruno doesn't, again, speak any English nor Alan German. But Bruno knows someone that works at another club down the street called the Heaven and Hell, and he pays a messenger to go down and get this guy. His name is George Steiner. He's a translator. And through George Steiner, Bruno says, "You were supposed to send me tapes of the Beatles. Why didn't you do it?" And Alan says, "Well, I just forgot. You know, one thing led to another," or as John Lennon would say, "Life is what happens while you're busy making other plans, and I forgot." And he says, "Well, I came to London because I couldn't remember where you lived, trying to find the Beatles. And I was going to settle for this group that's on stage right now, but what I really wanted were these Beatles that you talked about. And so I came to the wrong city, but here you are on this one night in this one place, and a translator happens to be
it's fate.
Down." And, of course, the end of the story is that the Beatles go to Hamburg and change themselves forever and become the group that we know.
Interesting. Let's go to Joe in the Bronx. Hey, Joseph, go ahead.
Hey, George. Very good segment.
Thank you. I know it. You love music. This is down your alley.
I do, definitely. Jude, I wanted to ask you a question about Sid Bernstein, who I met at our pro shop. And he listened to a ballad of mine called Going Home Alone. He liked it, but I asked him at the time who his favorite Beatle was, and he answered John Lennon. Now, I've also met May Pang, and a friend of mine, David Brigati, was with Joey D and the Starlight. His brother, Eddie Brigati, was with the Rascals. I wanted to know, how did Sid Bernstein get to be the promoter for the Shea Stadium concert? And also, do you know anything about that that gig in Sweden where the Beatles opened for Joey D and the Starlighters?
Well, Sid really had both polish and savvy and chutzpah, because he got Brian Epstein's home number and called Brian and suggested that when Brian was coming to New York in 1963, that they meet and talk about getting the Beatles to perform in Carnegie Hall. And the Carnegie Hall gig went so well that he really wants the Beatles to book Madison Square Garden. After Carnegie Hall is over with, he walks Brian down toward Madison Square Garden and says, "They could play in a venue like this. They would be successful. They would fill this place." And Brian's like, no, they're not ready for this. I don't want to book them in a place that's too large, because if they don't fill it, they look like a failure. And he drops it, and he totally negates the idea of Madison Square Garden. So that's okay. You know, Sid, he was a sweet man, kind man, but he had a dream. And when he had a dream, he didn't let it go. So he waits a few months, and then he calls Brian again and says, "Brian, I have a different idea for you. It's bigger than Madison Square Garden. It's a stadium." And, of course, you know, at this time, there are no stadium concerts. This hasn't been done. We're used to them now. This is a thing that happens all the time. But in that day and age, there were no stadium concerts. And he says to him, "I will buy every ticket. I personally will buy every ticket that doesn't sell. You, I will guarantee it, you will not lose money on this venture." And says, "Okay, but here are some stipulations. You can't promote this. You can't advertise it. You can't do anything that would humiliate the boys if this doesn't work out." And then Sid said, "Well, how do you want me to sell it? How am I expected to fill the stadium?" He said, "You can only do it by word of mouth." So Sid starts going into Washington Square, telling the teenagers there, "The Beatles are coming. The Beatles are coming."
Now that's without social networking, too.
Exactly. Exactly. And the word starts to spread. Well, when the tickets finally go on sale, they sell out almost instantaneously. So Sid, I know that you know what a great guy he was, but when he had a dream, he would not relent. And so, of course, Shea Stadium happened, and it was his baby.
All right, let's go back to the calls. Let us go to, thank you, by the way, Joe. Let's go to Michael in British Columbia, Canada. Hey, Michael, thank you for calling. Go ahead, sir.
Hello, George.
Hey, Mike.
Well, always good to hear Friday My Mind by the Easy Beats. And if you and Tommy DeGann can slide in Swinging Medallions, Double Shot My Baby's Love, we'd love that too. And certainly the history here is incredible, you know, from metamorphosing from a skiffle band joining the Moondogs, Quarrymen, Silver Beatles to the Beatles. But my question to Jude is, in the reading of the book, The Many Lives of John Lennon, it described a very dark, sadistical side of John. And in one event, he got into a fight with Stu Sutcliffe, and he was on the ground, and he had kicked Stu Sutcliffe in the head, and this possibly led to the aneurysm that caused his subsequent death. And what can Jude portray on this?
Jeez, what do you know about that, Jude?
Yeah, I absolutely do. When Pauline Sutcliffe was still alive, who is Stu's sister, and this story was first proposed, she went insane saying that this is not true, that John and Stu were absolute best friends. In fact, they were more than best friends. They wrote 19 and 20-page letters to each other. They loved one another as brothers. And she stood up and said, this is a fabrication. This isn't true. No way. Bill Harry, if you will read Bill Harry's account of this, and he has written so many books about the Beatles, The Ultimate Beatles Encyclopedia, Liverpool Bigger Than the Beatles, The Beatles Encyclopedia of People, and on and on and on. And Bill was there. He was close friends with Stu, very close friends with Stu, and close friends with John. And he denies it emphatically. And he said, not until Pauline Sutcliffe was offered a huge sum of money did she say nothing when Goldman wrote The Lives of John Lennon and claimed this, and then she said nothing because she had been offered a large sum of money. So this was not true. John did not kick him in the head. Stu did get kicked in the head outside of, some biographers say, Latham Hall, others say Litherland Town Hall. The girls had been screaming at the Beatles, and Stu went out first to load the van. John came out second and found him being beaten fiercely and kicked in the head. John attacked them, although he was well outnumbered. There were eight people attacking Stu, and it was just John and Stu. John broke his little finger in the fray for the rest of his life. You can look at his finger and see that it stuck out at a weird angle. Stu refused to be taken to the hospital. He did not want his mother, who was raising the family alone at this point, to incur that expense. He was bleeding from the ears. He went home without getting medical attention and later developed an aneurysm. Had absolutely nothing to do with John Lennon.
All right, let's take a few more calls before the end of the show. Let's go to Joe in Long Island. Welcome to the program. Hi, Joe.
Yeah, Jude, that initial relationship with the Rolling Stones, they exchanged the song in 63, The Man, or something like that. And then Lennon played the piano on the song We Love You by the Rolling Stones. So I'd ask you about their initial relationship, and also Yoko being in Tokyo when they carpet bombed Tokyo. That must have been very traumatic.
Well, they were great, great friends with the Stones, and you're right. The Stones had a hit. I think they went to, like, number 17 with the first song that they did. And one day, John and Paul are in a taxi. They've been to lunch, and they're driving home from lunch, and they see Andrew Luke Oldham, the Stones' manager, standing on a street corner, and they pull over to give him a ride in the taxi. And when he jumps in, he says, listen, fellas, it's great to see you because we need a song. He knew the Beatles were writing for lots of people at that time, for Cilla Black, for Billy J. Kramer, Tommy Quickley. And he says, you know, can't you dash off something that the Stones can have that's going to take them to number one? And Paul kind of cuts his eyes at John and says, well, we've got a song we've been working on called I Want to Be Your Man, but we haven't finished it. And Oldman, being very savvy, says, I tell you what, get the taxi driver to drive us over to the studio where the boys are, and I'll pay for your taxi if you'll go in and finish that song. But they do go in. They're great friends with the Stones, visit with them, laugh, talk. And then John and Paul go in a side room and finish the song, I Want to Be Your Man. They give it to the Stones and say, you can have this song to record with the stipulation, because we're recording it for our LP with the Beatles. If you'll let us record it as well, you can release it first. We'll let you release it first. But if you'll give us the right to let Ringo sing it, because it's really in his range and so forth, we'll let you have it. The Stones take it. It's their first number one, and it just cements what's already a great relationship.
Oh, that's perfect. Jude, thanks for being on the program. Should Have Known Better is the book, available at Amazon and all over the place. For Dan Galante, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean Latasseur, Stephanie Smith, Chris Burrows, Tim Banal, George Knapp, and Ian Punnett, I'm George Norrie, somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM. We'll see you on our next edition. Until then, be safe, everyone.